The Word of Mouth Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. New measles cases in the U.S. continue to make headlines, the latest involving an outbreak linked to a Las Vegas casino just this weekend. Parents who decide to delay or forgo the MMR, or measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine, are being blamed for the spread of the disease. In an article for Slate, Ruth Graham goes one step further, saying it's not parents who are to blame. It's moms. Ruth Graham is a New Hampshire-based freelance journalist and a regular contributor to Slate. And Ruth, great to have you back on the show.
Thank you.
So it's a pretty hot topic, and you're pretty much poking the bear here by blaming mothers. How are people reacting?
It is. Well, it's definitely an uncomfortable question. It's uncomfortable for me, particularly as a woman. And I would say, you know, there's been a positive, you know, I've definitely had positive reactions. The negative reactions have been, well, it's rude, it's uncomfortable, it's blaming moms for something that is maybe a more complicated issue. But no one's really said that it's not their fault or that they're not the ones driving these decisions. So I don't know. I think I might be onto something.
Well, and you do back it up with some research, plenty of it, that found that women do indeed make the vast majority of healthcare decisions for their families. But what do studies show about where they're getting their information to inform these decisions?
Well, that's the interesting thing. So it's pretty obvious, I think, and it is backed up by research that moms make the overwhelming majority of decisions about healthcare. But the more interesting research to me is that they're getting their information more from anecdotal information from the web. So there was a study last year that said women are 30% likelier to rely on sort of anecdotal Googling. And then a study from 2011, which is even more directly applicable to this issue, which is that for vaccine information specifically, women are likelier than men to trust magazine stories, to trust television, to trust stories from their friends. And really most shocking to me, they're more likely to place trust in celebrities, which, you know, when I hear that, I immediately think of Jenny McCarthy.
Right,
and
there
get
been
a little
some
depressed.
Loud celebrity exactly. Voices in this debate.
Exactly.
So faith in anecdotal evidence when it comes to not vaccinating, why do you think the pendulum does not swing the other way? In other words, why not trust anecdotal information that says vaccination is good?
Well, that's the disturbing thing, because obviously there's much more of that anecdotal evidence out there in the world. And when researchers have tried to shift their tactics and present more of this anecdotal information, this is research in its early stages, but there isn't evidence so far that that really works. And it's disturbing. But that research is sort of in its infancy. So we'll see.
Ruth, is this a bigger issue? I mean, a fundamental distrust of science, or maybe the way it's presented, or finding the right mouthpiece?
I think that's a big part of it. And there is this whole historical element here where women's stories about their own health, their claims about their own symptoms have been discounted by a lot of the mainstream medical establishment for, you know, decades, probably, you know, going back much farther than that. So if you think about women with chronic fatigue syndrome, with mental illnesses, and there's a variety of ways in which women's stories about their own health have not been taken seriously by the medical establishment. I think that's a big part of this. Even with autism specifically, which obviously looms very large over the vaccine debate, Researchers spent decades focusing on this idea of refrigerator mothers, which are insufficiently loving mothers, causing autism. That's now been totally discredited. But if you think about that kind of lurking in the back of this conversation, you can understand why some of these mothers specifically might be a little wary of just trusting this information that's coming down from on high from their doctors.
So plenty of reasons to disbelieve doctors or, absolutely, let's say, the medical establishment. Mm-hmm. But are we on a slippery slope here when we're talking about women as – is there a risk of saying women are more likely to be anti-science?
I think there is. And I think – I mean, that to me is the most uncomfortable part of asking this question. And I think one thing that's really important to note is that the majority of mothers – do trust their doctors on these questions. Women place more trust in their doctors than they do in celebrities and magazine articles. So we're really talking about a subset of parents here. And some of the loudest voices in the vaccine debate have been men. So Andrew Wakefield, the author of this now completely discredited 1998 study, exactly, was a man. And there are certainly fathers involved in this debate. So we're talking about a subset of women, and we're not talking about the entirety of the vaccine debate.
So to reframe this story or narrative about vaccines, whether they're good or bad, what's the answer? You change who it's directed to or how it is presented?
Well, I think what I was trying to argue in the story is that maybe recognizing who the information needs to be directed to might involve changing the way that we're telling those stories or presenting that information. So again, you know, the overwhelming majority of parents do vaccinate their kids. But if we're trying to sort of capture that last percentage of holdouts, recognizing that maybe more of them are women, that we need to be speaking to women, it would be nice if we could just present the sort of straightforward scientific information, but that's obviously not resonating with everyone. So if people respond to scientific information in different ways, maybe we need to be presenting that in different ways. So if that's just a change in tone, if it's celebrity spokespeople speaking up for vaccines, if it is presenting, you know, anecdotal information in a different way that we haven't tried yet, I think it's important to know who we're speaking to when we're talking about sort of closing that final gap.
Ruth Graham, New Hampshire-based freelance journalist and a regular contributor to Slate. That's where we found her article, Don't Blame Parents for Vaccine Resistance. Ruth, thank you.
Thank you.
Now, you'll find a link to read her article at our website. That's wordofmouthradio.org. In the early days of medicine, pharmacies were filled with treatments and tinctures that claimed to be made from things like Job's tears or unicorn root and something called meat juice for those suffering from anemia. The Stable Ledbetter Apothecary Museum in Old Town Alexandria, Virginia, just outside of D.C., is a fully preserved 19th-century pharmacy that lets visitors take a step back in medical time. Lauren Ober spoke to museum curator Callie Stapp and brings us this story.
For those of us who were born after the 1930s, what is an apothecary?
An apothecary is essentially a doctor and pharmacist all rolled into one. So he would dispense medicines just like a drugstore we think of today.
Describe for us what this looks like in here.
In the 1850s, the son of the original founder decided he would spruce things up a bit. So it looks a little bit gingerbready house inside. And then you also put in some really fun counters that have beveled glass to really show off your fun products like hair tonics and perfumes. But then you also have our label under glass bottles, which contained all of the raw ingredients that you would use in all of your medicines. So they have fun colors. Some are blue, some are yellow, some have actual bits of bark in them and things like that, but they were meant to show off. So they're done in nice foil glass labels.
There are tons of these glass bottles. A lot of these have stuff in them still, which creeps me out a little bit. So are these the real things that the apothecary would use?
They are. This is the same materials. That's one of the great things about our collection is that we have the original materials in them that they would have used in the 1850s.
You ever opened any of these up and smelled them?
No.
Why not?
I can only imagine how terrible they would smell.
Really? You've never been tempted just to put your face in there and just take a whiff?
We have boxes of mostly root-type material upstairs. One of them is a skunk cabbage root, and it smells pretty terrible. I can only imagine it probably smells slightly less terrible than it smelled 100 years ago, but pretty awful smelling. So,
or more terrible if it's been sitting around for 100 years.
One can only guess how terrible it is.
So with all of these medicines, like how would they prepare them?
So you would come in and describe what you needed, and the pharmacist or apothecary would, you know, pull out the raw ingredients. And you would use a mortar and pestle a lot of times if you had especially like roots or things that needed to be ground up that weren't already in a liquid form. And so you would just take it and you would just smash it down, just like you do for, you know, cooking and things like that today.
Yeah, so they would get at it in there and grind it up.
That's it. And then you could put it in your whatever you're using with. So if you're making it into a pill form, you can put a little bit of sugar or chocolate around it. You can use a pill roller, which we have several of, and you could roll it out into long pieces and then little smaller bits and send it off with the customer.
Shall we go have a look-see upstairs?
Let's go upstairs because you will probably find a few things that you will have never seen before. We usually use it as our Harry Potter room. So a lot of kids get very excited because it kind of looks like the apothecary from Harry Potter.
Oh, this is something.
So we have what is essentially walls on each side and down the middle of raw ingredients in tins and also in drawers that have the ingredients pasted, you know, painted on the front.
Do any of these drawers have stuff still in them?
Most of the drawers actually still have things in them. We have wild carrot tops, which are always really fun. Job's tears, which are just basically small berries. A lot of times you would give them to kids to teeth on.
What are some of your favorite like areas or things, not maybe your most favorite, but some of your favorites?
So one of the things that is kind of among one of my favorites is what's called the Valentine's meat juice. This gentleman named Man Valentine had a very sickly wife. And so he invented something that would press raw meat and you would take the juice from that and you would combine it with, you know, a few other things and serve it to people who were probably very anemic and kind of sickly and they got better.
Why couldn't they just eat meat?
That is a good question. I don't have the answer for that, but it took off. We have beef, wine, and iron. That was also very popular.
If you're pressing out a slab of meat for the juice, you could just eat the meat, I guess. I don't know.
Maybe they're just thinning it out. It's a little bit cheaper. It's just one of the things that takes off.
Could you imagine in 200 years a preserved CVS as a museum?
Not at all. Not in the least.
And that story was produced by Lauren Ober. Up next, we're going to hear about some contemporary unproven claims about miracle foods. That's when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Acai berry will help you lose weight. Coconut oil prevents Alzheimer's. And a dose of apple cider vinegar will protect you from cancers. Who wouldn't want that? The promises of so-called miracle foods make it difficult for consumers to tell fact from fiction. Daryl Mohammadi is a science and health writer, and he looked into the truth about miracle foods for The Guardian. Daryl, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you very much for having me.
So what are some of the biggies in the superfood sweeps, if we can say that?
So the big ones, the ones that you mentioned are kind of coconut oil, but we've also got things like chia seeds, apple cider vinegar, spirulina, and of course, manuka honey, which many of us are familiar with.
Now you talk to doctors and to researchers. Any of the claims that they've made proven?
None of the big claims about preventing cancer or diabetes or heart disease, unfortunately, because it would be so nice if they were true, but unfortunately, none of them are backed up by proper science.
Well, it's hard for us to tell because we read about these things being antioxidants or free radicals. What is that language actually saying?
So free radicals and antioxidants, we see them everywhere, and they're actually part of a very important biological process that goes on inside our body. Let's start with free radicals. Now, they're elements that come spinning off any chemical reaction in our body that uses oxygen. Now, they're unstable because they're missing an electron. They'll do anything to get this electron back. They'll beg, steal, and borrow. And what they end up doing is they end up stealing electrons from, say, for instance, fats in your cell membrane. And if the cell's old, then losing this electron might cause it to die. Or the free radical could take an electron from your DNA. It'll damage your DNA, and that means that it messes the genetic recipe, if you like, for how new cells are made. So when new cells are made, they are abnormal and can turn out to be cancerous. Now, this kind of damage is called oxidative stress, and it is linked to heart disease, diabetes, and cancer. But our bodies make these things called antioxidants. Now, they're a bit like people standing outside a nightclub handing out hugs and hot chocolate to pacify drunken revelers. They're at hand to give these free radicals the electrons that they crave so they don't go off and cause damage elsewhere. So a logical step, you might think, is that if we eat a bunch of foods that are rich in antioxidants, it'll reduce oxidative stress and then the diseases that can come with it. But there's no actual evidence to show that eating foods rich in antioxidants can do this. Also, even if these foods did do what they claim to do and wipe out all the free radicals, you'd probably be dead or very unwell. We need free radicals for things like programmed cell death, for cell communication, muscle regeneration. So the whole concept of eating foods rich in antioxidants is, as far as I can tell, a bit of a non-science.
But if we look at it, you know, honey, apple cider vinegar, coconut oil, they may not deliver on what they promise to deliver, but are any of them bad for us?
Not necessarily bad for you, but say, for instance, coconut oil. If it's marketed as this kind of good source of oil, then people think they should eat it every day. Now, coconut oil is a saturated fat, which, like butter, we used to think it was this evil artery-clogging substance. But now studies show that maybe it's not that bad for you if you eat it in moderation. But certainly, if you eat too much of it, it could lead to things like heart disease. Likewise, with Manuka honey, it's got these certain antibacterial properties in really, really tiny amounts. If you balance that against the vast quantities of sugar you'll eat while kind of eating massive spoons of Manuka honey, then that might do you some damage.
Then why do consumers fall for it and we do it so quickly? You know, kale was all the rage last year. Now it's cauliflower, for example, or coconut oil.
Yeah. So we need to ask ourselves about this kind of machinery that surrounds these miracle foods. Why does it exist? It exists because, wouldn't it be marvelous? We all want a miracle. And if that miracle involves eating tasty coconut oil in my potato salad, then sign me up. That's my kind of miracle. You know, it's an easy, easy sell. And talking of selling, there are, like I said, there's this whole machinery around the foods. Part of it are celebrity health gurus. I think poor old Gwyneth Paltrow has been getting a bit of a hard time over here in England anyway, you know, publishing her stuff about the detox diet. And in these instances, these people are usually flogging a book. So you follow the money and you're going to get the answer to your question. But then there are two other factors to why this myth is continued. And there's another couple of sources, one of which are articles and blogs that we've all seen them online. Our friends post them on Facebook, or we see them in the sponsored section at the bottom of articles that we read. And they're titled things like "The 10 Scientifically Proven Health Benefits of Eating Coconut Oil." Now, these articles are written by probably well-intentioned individuals who piece together cherry-picked bits of science, often from studies done in animals or in cell cultures or in really small human sample sizes. And what they end up doing is they string together a narrative that supports or disproves a certain food being healthy or not. These aren't the best places to go for your information. Then the second chief propagators of the myth are people who've genuinely experienced the positive effect of having these foods. And this is what we call anecdotal evidence. Now, there's a saying, I'm not sure where it's from, and that saying is, the plural of anecdote is an evidence. Now, what this means is that although you may have experienced health benefits eating a specific food, and maybe your friends have experienced health benefits too, now, until it's properly and robustly scientifically proven, there's a chance that it could have actually happened by chance. So a practical example of this is, if you would have just forked out $20 for a tub of miracle oil, you're probably going to be less likely to shovel down a bucket of chicken, or you're less likely to have been out drinking because you're going to be more mindful about your health. There's a chance that the health complaint that you were experiencing might have resolved as a consequence of this healthier lifestyle, and then you draw a correlation between the two.
Dari, you wrote about miracle foods for a British newspaper. Here in the U.S., claims about food are supposed to be regulated by the FDA. There's no regulation of so-called miracle foods here. And how about in Europe?
I think the claims are regulated. I think manufacturers can't, say, for instance, put on their label that this food will cure cancer, for instance, or help you lose weight. But the myth is propagated by these bloggers and these articles and these celebrity health gurus who aren't liable to, they don't need to submit their blogs to the FDA, for instance. You can claim that your product is rich in antioxidants because often it is. But there's no evidence to suggest that by consuming antioxidants, we will have any health benefits because our body seems to make enough antioxidants itself. If you look at the antioxidants circulating in your blood right now, you'll find mainly the ones that we make ourselves, uric acid, for instance, and ones that we have from a healthy, balanced lifestyle like vitamins A, C, and E.
So if miracle foods are not the panaceas that they are made out to be, how do we stay healthy?
So I should probably preface anything that I'm about to say by saying that I'm not a doctor, I'm not at all qualified to give any health advice. But speaking with doctors when I was researching this article, the messages that doctors want to give, the problem with them is that they're not very sexy. There are things that we know already. These are things like fruit and vegetables are good for you. Whole grain cereals are good as well. And you probably shouldn't be eating too much trans fat and don't smoke and do some exercise from time to time. But the thing is, they're in this arena where they're competing with marketing people and sales people who are, they use words like miracles, which are much more...
sexy.
Yeah. Yeah, which are much more sexy and appealing. The problem that with the language that doctors and scientists use is that it's always couched in uncertainty. Science does have answers for a lot of things, but there are also a lot of things that scientists are still trying to work out. That's why recommendations that dietitians and doctors make, they're always couched in this uncertainty. Like, they use things like, there's a high chance that eating food X will lead to disease Y, or eating food Z will likely lead to better health if eaten within a healthy lifestyle. These aren't very punchy.
Dara Mohammadi, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you very much, Virginia.
Dara Mohammadi, he's a science and health writer. We found his article, The Truth About Miracle Foods, From Chia Seeds to Coconut Oil, at The Guardian. You can read it for yourself at wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Before the break, we talked about the unproven claims about miracle foods like Manuka honey and coconut oil. Also declared to be a superfood is the acai berry, a humble staple of the Amazonian diet before it popped up in the health food aisle. Early in the acai boom, reporter Kelly Weiss reported from Brazil on the local fruit that burst onto the global market.
In the Amazonian city of Macapá, red flags fly outside of lots of little shops. That means they're selling acai, and locals will stop in to buy it every day, like Benichito Itamagama dos Santos, who both sells and eats acai.
56 anos que eu tenho, todo tempo eu como acai.
For the 56 years that I've lived, I've eaten acai the entire time.
A gente come, faz parte da refeição. No almoço, na janta, tem a carne, tem o peixe e o açaí com a farinha da mandioca que a gente come.
Açaí is part of our meals, both at lunch and dinner. We mix it in with manioc flour and we eat it with either meat or fish.
Eventually, weightlifters and athletes in Brazil's bigger cities discovered açaí packed with antioxidants and calories. And then some business-savvy surfers came along and got a taste.
We kept going, hey, we got to have that acai stuff again.
That's Ryan Black. He's the co-founder of the American acai company, Sambazon, that Samba and Amazon put together. Today, Ryan Black's riding on a chartered boat down the Amazon River. He says 10 years ago, he was 25 and on vacation in Brazil. After surfing, he says somebody gave him acai.
We ate it in a bowl with granola and loved it.
Ryan and his brother Jeremy Black then set out to bring the berry to the United States. As they say, they were just punk kids, but they found a market. Today, Sambazon is a multi-million dollar company that sells acai juice and smoothie products in the U.S., and it all comes from the Amazon. We take a small motorboat to an acai farm to see how it's harvested. Jeremy Black points out the berry growing wild along the Amazon River on spindly palm trees.
So we're out here deep in the forest,
just up a little tributary, and we just saw a guy climb up about a 40, 50-foot tree and pull down a couple stalks of acai.
Jeremy Black says his company pays growers a minimum price for acai and often above the market value. And he says it's an organic operation. Growers can't cut down the trees to harvest acai or use harmful chemicals in the rainforest.
The cool thing is the propagation of this fruit is doing amazing things for the people down here, because something that was growing in their backyard 10 years ago and wasn't worth anything is now able to provide them with a livelihood and give them a reason to stay and take care of the land and live there and enjoy it and take care of their families.
Yes, a lot of that is true, but Professor Eduardo Brondizio of Indiana University says the globalization of acai is a little more complicated than that.
It's a fascinating story because there is no clear cut to it, no good and bad, no, you know, right or wrong.
Brondizio wrote a book about the growing market of acai. He says even though acai production has increased tenfold in some parts of the Amazon, staggering poverty persists. People lack basic services like plumbing, electricity, and clean water. And Professor Brondizio says one reason for this, the Amazon is mainly an exporter of acai. Because of this, he says, the economic gains from the berry are sent out of the region as well, just like always in the Amazon.
So it also shows, you know, an important lesson about globalization, that even the strongest markets may not change local conditions if you don't change the way local areas participate in an expanding economy.
Brondizio says local growers do make more money from acai, but not year-round. And for the people who depend on acai, at times their food staple seems like a luxury item. Brondizio says sometimes acai is more expensive than beef. Back in Macapa, the acai seller and enthusiast Binichitu Itamagama dos Santos moves around his tiny shop attached to his house. His feet are bare and his shirt has holes in it. He says he knows little about the acai craze spreading around Brazil and the world, but he does know prices are up and he's selling less acai.
Before, here in Brazil, acai was the food of poor people. And that's historically been the case. But today, if you earn minimum wage here in Brazil, it's hard. You can't consume acai every day because it's getting very expensive.
That's true for two customers who stop by Dos Santos' shop. They don't want to be interviewed, but say that indeed acai is now too pricey to buy every day. And they say that's hard to adjust to because a meal isn't a meal here without acai.
And that report originally aired on the World Vision Report. Stay with us for the story of how marketers discovered a secret weapon for selling antiseptic, halitosis, the medical condition pretty much created by Listerine. That's when Word of Mouth continues after a short break. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott.
Halitosis is a real everyday problem. By far its most common cause is fermentation of proteins that are present in everybody's mouth all the time. The trouble is you could have halitosis and never know it, and even your best friend won't tell you.
Sound there from a 1952 commercial for Listerine, which, as you can hear, is largely focused on halitosis, the medical term for bad breath. But Listerine was not created to fight halitosis. That particular use was dreamt up by who else? Advertisers. Sarah Zhang is a staff writer at Gizmodo, where she wrote about the origins of Listerine as mouthwash. And Sarah, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi. Hello. Thank you for having me.
What was Listerine originally marketed for and when?
Right. So Listerine was actually invented in 1879 by a doctor. So this is around the time in which we were just starting to understand germ theory. And, you know, surgeons were seeing that if they disinfected wounds, they were less likely to get infections in patients. So, you know, Listerine is basically alcohol-based, and it basically kills all the bacteria it touches. So for the first few decades, you know, in which Listerine existed, it was actually only available to doctors to use in surgery. And then in 1914, the company that owned Listerine, which was called Lambert Pharmacol Company at the time, decided that they, you know, might have a wider audience for Listerine. So if you look at early ads, they actually, you know, we think of Listerine now as synonymous with mouthwash, but actually the early ads kind of sell it for all sorts of purposes. It's kind of as a general disinfectant, for using cuts and scrapes, for using dandruff. I even found an ad for using it as a douche fluid. So it was really all over the place. But it wasn't really until they found the idea of halitosis that it became the mouthwash that we know today.
They found the idea of halitosis? Tell me about that.
Yeah, so this is kind of an interesting story. And so Gerald Lambert, who owned the company, had tells this story in which he was in this brainstorming session with a chemist in the company, and they were just kind of going over, like, you know, what can we sell Listerine for? And the chemist just kind of has this clipping from a British medical journal, and he says, oh, you know, it says something about halitosis, and Gerald describes it almost as like a light bulb going up over his head, and it's like, oh, halitosis, you know, this is like a medical term. And it kind of gives this authoritative air to something that we have experienced, but didn't really realize was pathological. So Listerine sort of starts this new advertising campaign where they start preying on social fears of bad breath.
So that sounds like such an advertiser's goldmine, identifying something that is a deficiency in human beings or makes something wrong with them.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, when you look at like at the advertisement we heard earlier in the segment, basically all these ads were saying, you know, bad breath is something that exists and now it has a medical term for it. And it's also something that people are too polite to tell you. So you'll see these ads that say, oh, you know, only your children might tell you because adults are too polite to tell you. Or you'll see ads where it's like one woman sitting sadly by his side, another couple being happy. And it's the idea that you're being ostracized or you're being held back because you had bad breath. But no one is going to tell you except for this ad. And look, we have the solution for it, which is mouthwash.
Well, let's hear just another Listerine jingle.
He said that she said that he had halitosis. She said that he said it's true of some girls too. He said that she said the answer was simple. Here's what she said to do. Try Listerine, buy Listerine, keep breath fresh and clean with Listerine.
So everybody's whispering about your bad breath. Listerine is now synonymous with mouthwash. And there have been studies on its efficacy in fighting gingivitis and plaque. But more recently, there's the idea that antibacterial mouthwash is being examined more closely. What for and how?
Yeah, that's right. So I think, you know, Listerine kind of comes out of what you might think of as like our first revolution for understanding microbes, which is that there are microbes out there everywhere and they are bad for you and they can cause disease. So I think now we're kind of entering like a second revolution in which we're understanding there are microbes out there everywhere inside you, especially inside your gut, and not all of them are bad. Some of them might even be good for you. And so just like how there are microbes in your gut, and, you know, taking antibiotics that kills all of them can sometimes cause problems. Perhaps maybe we actually have a community of microbes in our mouth as well. Perhaps if we have mouthwash that just kills them all the time, maybe that's not great for us either. And so, you know, there's sort of some interesting line of research that says, instead of killing everything, maybe we can try to hack the mouth microbiome in ways that are slightly more specific. So one example is the idea of probiotics. We often hear probiotics as something like a pill that you take to, you know, help your digestion. So this is kind of a similar idea, but for your mouth. So, for example, there's this one bacteria called Streptococcus salivaris K12, and it's kind of since shown that it may actually fight halitosis. So what researchers have done is basically had volunteers suck on lozenges that have been laced with this bacteria. And they've seen that, you know, after a few days, the volunteers had better breath. And it may be because they had an extra bacteria in their mouth rather than because they had no bacteria in their mouth.
I'm guessing that we might be seeing probiotic Listerine on the shelves soon enough.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, Listerine for now, for the most part, is alcohol-based, so it would have to be a completely different formulation. But this idea of probiotics is almost certainly something that will come in the future.
Sarah Zhang, thank you so much for filling us in on the true origins of Listerine.
Well, thank you for having me.
Sarah Zhang, she's a staff writer at Gizmodo. You can learn more about the origins of Listerine at wordofmouthradio.org. As we just heard, in the case of Listerine, 20th century advertisers have had a profound effect on public conception of germs and purity and cleanliness. Not that long ago, many people took a bath only once a week. Now many Americans shower every day. Olga Kazan took a look at global statistics on showering to see how geography and culture play into hygiene habits. And she joins us now to explain what she found. Olga, great to have you on Word of Mouth.
Great to be here.
Now, I think of the U.S. as a country fairly obsessed with cleanliness. How do we stack up compared to other countries when it comes to showering?
We're actually probably not the most frequent showers in the world. It looks like, at least from the poll that I looked at from Euromonitor, that some of the Latin American countries like Colombia, Brazil, and Mexico shower more frequently than us, and so do some Middle Eastern countries and places like Indonesia and Australia.
So do you attribute that to heat or culture or what?
You know, I'm not entirely sure because it doesn't really the heat explanation doesn't totally fit all of the countries, because you have Spain. According to this poll, people in Spain shower about as frequently as we do. People in Turkey shower slightly less frequently. And India is about on par with the U.S. And those are all places that are, you know, can be pretty balmy. So the heat explanation isn't really kind of the perfect answer. But, you know, it could be that people in places like Brazil or Colombia, you know, maybe it does get really warm there and you want to kind of cool off in the morning and at night, you know, with a quick shower, quick bath, just to kind of like refresh, you know, and maybe it's not so much about cleanliness as it is about just like it's hot and you want to kind of take a dip.
In which countries do they shower the least?
So it actually looks like Japan, the UK, and China from the Euromonitor poll. And then it looks like also Russia and Sweden on this other poll that I looked at by a company called SCA.
Well, we hear the old jokes, you know, right, that the French don't bathe, or Europeans in general. How do the French stack up?
France is actually right in line with the U.S. So that didn't actually bear out at all.
Now, did you break it down? Were these polls broken down by gender? Is it the same for men and women?
In most countries, women showered slightly more frequently, or at least they said that they did. And in Sweden is the only country that they polled where the men actually showered more frequently.
Now, when you're looking at this, you found that in the early 20th century, Americans really ramped up in showering. Why was that at that time?
Well, so, I mean, you had a lot of companies kind of coming forward and trying to, you know, sell soap for different and new purposes. So, you know, where originally you might only sell soap for washing clothes, suddenly you want people to buy soap to wash themselves. And of course, once you have that, you want them to use it frequently. So these companies, but also doctors at the time and maybe some influencers like Dale Carnegie started sort of promoting this idea that as people were working in closer quarters and moving into offices, rather than, you know, working on the farm, that they should be clean and smell really nice all the time so that they can be, you know, pleasant for their coworkers.
Has that paralleled what's gone on in other countries and cultures? I mean, is that also due to marketing, or are there other factors at work?
So I did read a bunch of business reports about kind of the state of showering in various countries, which I can't believe people analyze, but they do. And it does look like in countries that are even emerging right now that there are soap manufacturers and other companies that are trying to promote kind of bathing and showering more frequently in areas where people, that just might not be part of the lifestyle because it's not very practical. So like rural areas of China, people are increasingly starting to, you know, bathe and shower almost as frequently as they do in the cities. And so the soap manufacturers are really excited about that because, of course, that's a new market for them.
We seem to be entering this age, you know, the no-poo, the anti-shampoo movement, where clean doesn't always equal healthy. Do you think we may see a drop in showering habits in the future?
I really think that we will, just based on how things are going. I mean, the movement of, I think it kind of started with women shampooing their hair less frequently, and that started a few years ago as women began to realize that, you know, if I go a few days without shampooing, at first my hair gets really gross, but then, you know, it actually improves. And I know, you know, some of my female friends said, you know, I bit the bullet and I went, you know, a week without shampooing my hair, but then after that week was over, you know, my hair was completely fine, and now it looks normal and healthy all the time, and I almost never have to shampoo it, which is actually, you know, by some definitions, like, that's how frequently shampoo should be used anyway, is just, you know, once or twice a week. And so I think that, you know, some people are experimenting with doing the same thing with showering, maybe not quite on the same scale, but alternating days or skipping days, and it's finding that their skin is less dry or that they have less eczema. And so for some people, it really does work, and it's something that they want to try.
Olga Kazan, thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Olga Kazan, she's staff writer at The Atlantic, where she covers health. And you can check out her article, complete with a lot of interesting graphs on global showering statistics. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. You may have noticed a theme running through today's show. Much of it has been about how we learn about and interpret health-related issues, or how those messages can influence our thinking. Our next story is about one of the people who can look inside of your brain, a healthcare worker who would rather be playing music. Joshua McNichols produces the podcast Day Job.
What can you tell about a person from their brain waves?
All right, Joshua. So first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to measure your head.
Ivan Galvez works for Swedish Medical Center in Seattle.
I'm going to apply these gold-plated electrodes on your scalp.
He runs an electroencephalogram machine.
So it's going to feel kind of gooey on your head.
It measures people's brain waves. Today, it's going to measure mine.
So I got a little bit of tape here. I'm just going to tape up.
Ivan runs a series of tests. Then he examines my brainwaves on his computer screen. To Ivan, they indicate I probably don't have epilepsy, and I haven't had a stroke.
Can you read people's minds?
You believe it or not, I'm asked that a lot. And can you control my movements? No, I cannot. All I'm doing is recording.
This job is a really big deal for Ivan. The stable income, the job security, it lets him spend his free time playing percussion for his band, Picoso. That stability is something his parents never had. Ivan's father had been an activist for the socialist government of Chile in the early 1970s. But in 1973, the country was taken over by the dictator Augusto Pinochet.
When the coup happened, books were burned. You were not allowed to say things about the government.
Ivan's father told Ivan about a musician named Victor Jara. Jara had been a critic of Pinochet's government.
The story that I heard was that they beat him and then they hurt his hands because he played guitar. And they sort of mocked him and they said, you know, all right, see if you can do it now. And he continued to try until he couldn't anymore.
No puedes volver atrás. No tienes más que seguir.
That was to be Jara's final performance. Shortly after that, he was killed. What happened to your parents?
Most of what happened was to my father. He was part of an underground movement of students that wanted to preserve literature. They literally buried records or books and bags and boxes in the ground to hide them. And if the military got any wind or any suspicion that you were involved in it, then they would take you.
Eventually, Ivan's father and mother fled for their lives. They arrived in the United States with only a few belongings. They had to start over from scratch. Ivan's father found a job as a dishwasher.
So, like, what would you see when he came home from work?
Just tired. Come home and just drop on the couch. As a kid, you observe that look on the face, that kind of, I'm tired of this shit, you know?
Among the items Ivan's father managed to smuggle out of Chile was a record. The song didn't even have any words, but under Pinochet, a folk song using traditional instruments was considered political protest.
I think that's the interesting thing about music is that you don't necessarily need a lot of words. There was so much said in that melody. You could hear the struggle, you could hear the triumph. I heard my message in that song.
Was that a moment when you knew you wanted to play music?
Yeah, I think so.
Ivan has a family of his own now. His day job at Swedish Medical Center lets him live more comfortably than his father ever did.
The time that my family was coming up and listening to music, it was really heavily involved in activism. In Picoso, what we're trying to get out is just, you know, not to worry so much. Have fun. Life's short.
And that story came to us from producer Joshua McNichols, the man behind the podcast Day Job. You can check it out online at dayjobmusic.org or find a link to it at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. We also invite you to follow us or send us your feedback or share your ideas for the program on Facebook and on Twitter. After all, the most fascinating stories travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please join us for more Word of Mouth tomorrow, too, on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quinby,
Logan Shannon,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
With help from our interns,
Fiona Shea and Katie McAuliffe.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.